This conference is being recorded.
Paula, I'm here too. This is Larry.
Oh, hey, Larry. I figured that's where you were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Good. Hope to see you guys up in Alexandria later in the month.
Well, Larry's coming. I'm coming for possibly one day.
Okay.
But Larry will be there for the duration.
Great, great. And Paula, we'll offline, we'll talk about the
Brownfield.
But that's great. Thank you for being a co-host. We're going to have a marketplace and open discussion, so we'll
that's terrific.
We'll co-facilitate it, and I'll give you some details of the gentleman who's coordinating it and everything. And your bio is probably up there online, I expect.
It might be.
Okay.
If not, I can.
Okay.
That's easy.
This is Angus Reed.
Hi, Angus. This is Glow. How are you today?
Okay.
One thing we were talking, Valerie, about, because Valerie's new, you might be interested in the Brownfields annual meeting. It's a great Brownfields national workshop. There's about 3,000 to 4,000 people that attend. This is going to be in New Orleans this year, and it's a great conference. It's everybody's there. In fact, in Valerie's situation, because she crosses a lot of disciplines, there are architects, insurance companies, financial people.
The whole real estate world.
Everybody is there. And it's November. It starts November 16th and runs for about 3 days. The power days are Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, 16th, 17th, 18th. And if you can see fit to get over there, it's a great conference. And go to the website, Brownfields.
2009.
Yeah,
Brownfields2009.org.
.org.
Or .com. Is it .org or .com?
I believe it's .org. And you can sign up. It's free. For that conference, you have to pay for your hotel and meals and transportation, but the conference itself is free.
Okay.
And it's a great conference. It's all of the people that you need to deal with will be there on a national level.
Okay.
They have a great exhibitor section that has all of the planners, architects, and remediators, and everyone's there. So it's a great conference.
So then what is this other one that you're referring to, this annual grantee meeting? What is that?
Right. We have an annual grantee meeting, which is, it's up until now, it's been pretty much restricted to people who have received EPA funding, either in the past or currently, and they're operating under the $200,000 grant from EPA. These people have all established job training programs, and what we do is get together and compare notes, and we break out into about eight groups. And really, the grantees run the meeting. They basically talk about issues, kind of like what we're doing here in the PLC group. But they're addressing all of the key components of operation of a grant, and it's basically a hashing out of issues. In addition, this year we're going to have quite a few EPA people there. We're going to have system administrators. We're going to have people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's catch up on who joined.
Gary Schleifer from South Florida, lead AP, joining in, just listening in.
Okay, Gary.
This is Harry James from the city of Miami.
Okay. Harry. Okay, great. City of Miami, great. Okay. The annual grantee meeting is one of all of those people who have had experience. This year, you know, they're making an exception to allow us to also invite the PLC members because they're on the road to developing a new program. Normally, we wouldn't do this, but it's a great opportunity to sit down with all of the people who have ongoing programs, and in addition, all of the EPA regional people and headquarters people who are administering and granting these grants for EPA.
Oh.
So it's useful. It's a it's a great I would say, if you're going to write a grant and submit it to EPA, I would highly recommend it, because I would say if you sit down and took really good notes on what's there, you could, you're halfway there to getting a pretty good grant written. So what
maybe
would you would you all agree it's a pretty useful conference? I think it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today we're going to talk about certifications. We kind of got off track last time, but we had some good interchange between Guy and Valerie about the energy certification. In general, one of the things that we can impart to our students when we recruit them and we train them and go through the curriculum, the issue is how do we get them good jobs? And one of the things that they have often is certifications, so that if you can market a person and say he's already certified to do certain jobs, it gives him a head up over the other person who may even have some training and experience but doesn't have the certs. So you could save the employer a certain amount of money in terms of the certifications. But we have to keep in mind that certifications are limited. And traditionally we've had, the big one has been what we call HAZWOPER. To get onto a hazardous waste site, you have to go through the 40-hour health and safety training, HAZWOPER we call it, 1910-120s, and the 40-hour. And associated with that, there's several others that are subsets of that. But we also have the lead and asbestos that Guy had been talking about. Guy said he's in training today. Actually, he's in energy training, so he really regretted not being able to be here. But he said he'll continue to make some comments on email, though. But the radon training is another one with certs. And now we're starting to move into this area of perhaps some sort of energy certifications. And we've got driver's license training, which isn't exactly an environmental or energy one, but most find it fairly useful. What, Angus and Harry, Larry, what do you find in terms of your certifications? What do you provide your students?
This is Larry. We provide, again, the HAZWOPER, confined space, asbestos, mold, all hazards, the OSHA construction. And I believe that's the six that we provide off the top of my head.
Right. So the confined space is a good one. That whenever you're going into a tank or any confined space, you would need that. The HAZWOPER to get on the waste site. The mold is really a good one, particularly down in Florida. Go ahead.
I would say asbestos sometime in some areas. I think the key would be to find out what is the need in your area as far as certifications. For instance, here in Miami, we were assessing whether there was a need for lead certifications, and it really wasn't that much need to get people certified in lead, but asbestos was still pretty high on the list. So I think you would have to find out what is the need in your area to when it comes to specific certifications.
This is Angus. One of the things that I'm discovering is that particularly in the area of mold and related things like that that might be associated with any kind of disaster cleanup, FEMA and related agencies seem to be narrowing greatly the certifications that they accept. So you either have to have something from IICRC or something from the Council on Indoor Air Quality when it comes to mold. All these other mold certifications aren't going to be counting for anything in the near future.
I would agree. One of the problems we have with all of these certifications, and we're the discussion we had this last week was related to that. we've got all kinds of people that want to get into the certification process, but the question is, who, what good are those certifications, and who's going to accept them? And that is relevant. In the case of HAZWOPR, of course, it's going to be the employer's responsibility, although if you could train someone to HAZWOPR, when they go to the employer, they're way ahead of the game. And they've already basically gone through the major portion of the training. The employer can do the peripheral training.
Rosalind Howard from Baltimore City.
Hi, Rosalind. How are you?
Well, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Great.
We're in the process of talking about certifications. Mike, you want to continue?
Yes, Rosalind. In fact, since you just joined, in terms of, in your experience, have you had any experience in terms of when people get hired, what types of requirements they might have for certifications of either energy or environmental people?
Well, for our weatherization program that's currently in progress, we are requiring each crew member to have the DOE certification. As such, our community colleges have a consortium, and they've developed a program utilizing the DOE requirements, and each crew member will have to participate and successfully complete that training program before they can do work in Baltimore City.
Oh, that's great. That's interesting. So the DOE, you're following the DOE model.
It's the DOE model coupled with portions of the training model that was that's offered in three sports.
Okay. Does Paul and Larry, are you familiar with the DOE certification?
I don't think so.
No.
Larry? No.
Nope.
We're going to have to look at that more
yep.
carefully.
I have the curriculum, but this is the Federal Department of Energy.
Yes.
This is U.S. Department of Energy.
Yes.
Okay. And the other one is, what was the other one you said? Frame.
Frame program I refer to.
Can't hear her.
Rosalind, could you repeat that?
The training program that I referred to was the program that was being conducted in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I can get you a contact person, our contact here who has coordinated it for the community colleges under the CTEC program.
That would be great. If you could email to the group the what would be good is to zero in on the certifications that everyone's starting to require. What's going to happen is people are going to start to move to a similar set of certifications, and it could be that this DOE one may be where people start to migrate. And if that's the case, then we'll want to, probably people who are in this need to at least look at that and include it as part of their curriculum.
I know several weatherization programs across at least the state of Maryland, the country, are in the process of pulling together some type of nationally recognized certification program so they can utilize these weatherization dollars that have come out from the era of the stimulus funding.
Right.
Yeah, there's tried the community colleges in or some community colleges have just been awarded some funds in Massachusetts from the new state clean energy center to do this, but there isn't right now a widely accepted standard, so the subject is new. Who was a certifying authority for this DOE? How does one get to be a certified authority for issuing the certification, or is that stuff I can find on somewhere on the DOE website?
I'm going to refer you to Carol Gillis, who was our coordinator here,
CTEC program, which was the Construction and Energy Technologies Consortium.
Okay.
And she can give you all the background and information, make sure it's accurate.
Could we get could we get one volunteer that would coordinate with Carol and then share with the group so we're not all contacting Carol?
Good idea. Perhaps I can we can certainly get a contact. I mean, hopefully we can get a contact. But perhaps I can also have Carol to join a conference call.
Oh, that would be great.
That'd be great.
Let's see if we could. Do you think we could get her on next week, next Wednesday?
I will certainly call and see if she's available.
Okay, if she is, that would be great to talk to her.
Certainly.
I think that's going to be an open-ended issue is on weatherization. Now, Guy would say, well, there's not going to be a, it's not going to happen, but I think we're going to migrate to some sort of standard because people are going to want to have some sort of minimum training requirements. And for our programs, it kind of leaves us a little bit in a lurch if we're not training to, if we can say we're training to a standard like 1910, if there's a standard, eventually the federal, they'll come out with one or they may come out with minimal standards. At least if we're training to a DOE standard, if DOE's got something out there, it would really be helpful for us to know in terms of designing our curriculum. So at least we could be better than the DOE curriculum, but at least meeting all of the requirements of the DOE curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about these certifications, and most of you are familiar with that, that there's a hierarchy. There's the, you often on many of these, in term when the feds come out with a set of standards, they'll be very specific in terms of training requirements. But we're still in the state of states control many of the certifications. So often what happens, it goes through the health department, or it might go through the dean or the environmental department, or it might even go through the housing department. And the states have first dibs on setting their certification standards that can be more stringent than the federal, not less. So states have, in the case of many of these pollutants, they have the right to adopt the certification requirements or the training requirements, or they can accept not to. This started with the OSHA requirements. States had the right to take over OSHA or leave it up to the federal. So if the states defaulted and did nothing, those states would just fall under federal standards. Otherwise, it was the state regs that controlled it. So whenever we were talking to grantees, we suggest to them first place to start is in your state and to see of these 8 or 9 certifications, which ones are they controlling and then what are their standards for those. If they have no responsibility, which is you go to them and they say, well, we don't have responsibility, it's a federal program, then you fall back to the federal guidelines on these. And that's basically, it starts with OSHA, all of the OSHA regs, and then flows through all the environmental regs, too. So we, being mindful of that in your particular state, that's it. But what will generally happen, we observe, is that we'll end up with a flurry of different types of certifications, and then at some point the federal government will come in and they'll set some minimum standards, and they'll set this up, and then they'll ask the states to adopt based on these standards, and then the states, some states will and some states won't. But it does give us kind of a guideline in certifications. In terms of what certifications we should be training to, I think you hit it right on the head there when you suggested that you found that you had asbestos need for that training but not lead paint, and because you're a younger town, if you're a newer city, in my case, in Raleigh, there's not much lead paint around, your railroad yards and things like that, but not necessarily in the housing construction. But then if you go to Boston or Charleston or Chicago, then it's quite a different story. I expect you all up in Boston have quite a bit of that going on with the HUD. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Yep. Are you training to lead now?
We will be this year. We're also interested at some point on this call for the R&P requirements. Just trying to understand what we're going to apply for training status, but at some point I'm interested in other people's experience, and again, that seems to be another, that's an EPA. I'm not sure if it's made its way to the state yet, but we've talked with our regional administrator, and it seems to be, it's coming. So, we'd like to be prepared ahead of time for when it finally does start to limit when they start to limit the qualifications of workers, all sorts of workers. You know, it's not just for brownfields, but for construction work. So, I'm not sure who it was that sent out this.
Might have
was
been
it
Guy.
Angus?
Was it you, Angus, or Guy?
I sent out some to Glow that she forwarded.
Okay. That was the EPA's new, it's about half a dozen pages of the RMP rule.
Right.
Okay. Angus, are you?
Go ahead.
Angus, are you... are you implementing the RRMP rule?
Yeah, we are applying for certification as a training facility. The easy part about RRMP is that EPA will supply you, with a textbook that you can reproduce. It will supply you with the PowerPoints to give to class. Now, the things you have to come up with is to develop a test for the course and to write up the practical exercises that you're going to do. There's a list of about 15 practical exercises you have to go through in the last 2 hours of the class. And so you have to write those up exactly how you're going to do it in your facility. So those are the two areas that you have to be creative. The rest of the stuff is pretty much handed to you.
Those are pretty hefty fees, aren't they, that you're going to have to pick up?
Well, it's about $500 or something to register as a...
Which ones are you going for? Are you...
we're just going to do our R&P.
Okay.
I don't think there's much... very limited need for the real lead remediation training, because unless you just want to do a lead worker certification, there's no reason to try to train lead inspectors or supervisors, because it wouldn't be worth it.
I came away from... Go ahead.
Question. What does RR&P stand for?
Innovation, repair, and painting.
Okay, thank you.
Basically, anyone who wants to work with HUD, and probably it'll be everyone, it's a HUD standard, they're going to have to meet the RRMP requirements unless your state has some more rigid requirements.
Okay.
But what scared me on that, I think it intimidated me, was looking at all the, lead has about five or six levels of super inspectors. And someone just joined? Okay.
I think maybe someone hung up, Mike.
Okay. The lead and the inspectors and supervisors, it becomes an issue of whether or not the demand is there to get all of those abilities to train those certifications. So it sounds like Angus is on track to just get the RRMP and maybe the lead worker.
Now, you got to remember on the RRMP that there's only one certification, and that is for what they call a contractor. Now, the thing with RR&P is that it is the responsibility of the person with the contractor certification to basically be on site where there is a renovation going on. And that contractor is responsible for training any other workers that are there. Not everyone has to be RR&P certified, but there has to be a site-specific safety plan and work plan for that site. There has to be records maintained and all that sort of thing. So if you have non-certified workers, there has to be, before they can start, they have to go through a site-specific safety briefing and everything for that site. And the site-specific plan has to be reviewed with them. So it's a lot easier just to certify everyone, I would think.
So you could set up a course that would be an RR&P course for trainer for our workers, and they could run through this and give them this extra certification so that when they go into these renovations, they're not going to have that hassle, because you'll give them all the documentation as part of the course.
Right, that's what they learn in the class, but it'll allow that worker to become a team leader or a site leader rather than just a worker.
Great. The lead worker is another issue too, and that's probably the power occupation of all of the lead issues. And the same thing. Now they have to approve your program, and they're going to give you all the materials also. Those are a little pricier, but I would say that would be the one. One problem that I see with this RR&P, it's going to severely limit the number of training providers out there, because there'll be a lot of people who are just going to not do this, so that's going to bring down the number of trainers, I would think. And it may be more difficult for those programs who hire out subcontract training to find training providers for these certifications.
Well, I think that, like in Georgia where I am, I don't expect there to be more than four to six certified trainers in the whole state by the time it all shakes out. But the thing that it's going to do as far as creating work is that once it goes into effect, whatever is February of next year, it will virtually, well, and depending on how much enforcement they want to do, it will eliminate our renovating out of their pickup truck and go to Home Depot and pick up day laborers and that sort of thing, because whatever they do in a pre-78 target housing will be illegal.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you, Angus. That's really helpful.
It is. We're kind of drawing close to our end. Why don't we, next week, if we can see if we can talk in more detail about, with Carol, what we'll do is, let's see if we could get, if Rosalind could get Carol committed to a few minutes on next Wednesday.
Okay.
Is that agreeable with everyone?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, I have a request. May I have the contact info for the mold guy from FEMA? Is he still on?
Anyone there that could provide some mold information?
That was Angus.
Oh, that was Angus?
Yeah, I can give some.
If you can just email everyone what you might be able to provide on the mold certification.
Okay. I'll try and find some information.
That'd be great. Okay.
I think I may have misspoken earlier. This is Ros. I just want to make sure that the training program that I was referencing was in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, not Shreveport.
Well, that's good. If
there are a couple of those centers across the country, but the closest one to Maryland was in Williamsport.
Okay. If, Rosalind, if you can, during the week or in the next couple of days, see if you get a hold of Carol, and if she's out of town or can't make it at all, perhaps we can get some contact information or some websites or URLs or something that you could share with the group. If she can join in, that'd be great.
Okay.
That'd be great. And if she can join in and has some URLs that we can go to prior to next week's meeting, that would even be better. Give us a chance to look at them.
Okay.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Why don't we we'll just adjourn till next week, next Wednesday, same time.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. See you guys later.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.